go in and arbitrarily draw a line in the sand, and I don't care if it's a 250 or 500 or a million, you're drawing that line across people's lives, their peculiar human experiences, their peculiar human needs, and I suggest their cultures in many instances in a matter that should be of great concern to this legislature. And I think that's wrong. I think it's contrary to the Constitution. I think it's bad public policy. And you're not going to show any evidence anywhere that anybody ever got anything back for doing that. And nobody's promised you anything if you do do it. Okay? So that's the compensatory damage issue. If someone wants to come down on the other side of that, if the legislature does, I can promise you this. Some very deserving people are going to get less money. Nobody's ever going to see a nickel of it from the insurance industry. And it would be a sad way to treat the most needy Alaskans in the scenario. Punitive damages, a much, much different question. Okay, why is it different? First of all, the Supreme Court regularly reverses punitive damage awards. Okay, that's just the way it is. Secondly, they don't have to do it too darn often to make the punitive damage discussion not terribly important. Why? Because those damages are rarely awarded, and almost never are they. You've heard that 90% of civil cases settle, and that's true, and in fact that projection's a bit low. Nowhere does anybody say, yeah, we'll settle for X, and oh yeah, we'll give you X on your punitive damage claim. It just doesn't happen. So you're looking about a part of the 10% that goes to trial and is won, and of that part, I mean, I'm sure it's a fraction of a percent, and I bet a small fraction of a percent of jury trials that end up with a punitive damage award. Okay? Now, when does that happen? Has there been some abuse? I mean, has there been some wrong outcome in the history of our system or some other? Well, of course there has. The thing's populated and run by humans. It's going to generate a bad outcome once in a while. But by and large, those awards occur where there has been some outrageous conduct, and the worth of the defendant is a consideration that the jury is usually aware of. And if you think you're going to change General Motors conduct with a $200,000 slap in the face, or even a $1 million slap in the face, when they decide that it's easier to produce a car that burns people because you can then turn them over to the insurance industry to deal with, and we'll all be money ahead in the end, that just isn't going to happen. Punitive damages need to be there to address egregious conduct, to get their attention in the boardroom where it makes a difference, to provide the economic incentive that these economic people called corporations feel. You know, nobody's down on the profit system. I expect a corporation to make money. It ought to make money. But if it responds only to economic incentive, sometimes compensatory damages just don't do it because it's not a tough enough rap. And so I think punitive damages play an extremely important role, rare though they are. You're not going to do anybody in this state any good by getting rid of them. You're not going to see insurance rates tumble. And by the way, the concern that how do you deter conduct when it's all paid for by insurance? Punitive damages are almost universally excluded from insurance coverage. First off, you don't get coverage for intentional conduct. And then because punitive damages are awarded when you are only reckless and thus you would have coverage, there's now an exclusion of punitive damages. And if you all go home and haul out your personal auto policy, you're going to see an exclusion for punitive or exemplary damages. I mean, I'll bet you a dollar to a hole in a donut it's there, if not once, many times. So do I think it's a good idea for Alaskans to have a cap on punitive damages? No, I don't. I think it's a terrible idea. And I think it really opens the door and puts the incentives in the wrong place to bad corporate conduct. The repeat offense not worth much money, but if you string, you know, a million occurrences out there worth a fortune, you're really making it open season on the people of this state if you get rid of that disincentive. Just like if you said, you know, no more fines for crimes. Get a little lecture from the judge. Have a nice day. Lastly, arbitration and alternative dispute resolution. You kind of got me between the devil and the deep blue sea on that one, and let me explain why, and let me tell you just real frankly what some of my concerns are. If you said to me, listen, Mike, there's a proposal that medical malpractice claims now be arbitrated instead of litigated, that there's, you know, a truncated discovery procedures and a zillion other things. What do you think about that? I'd have two responses, and I'd have a hard time telling you how. I mean, I can, if my organization takes a position, I'll be happy to repeat it. As a person and as a professional, here's the problem I got. You get more plaintiffs, you would get more claimants compensated, and probably more fairly compensated and more efficiently compensated in an alternate dispute resolution kind of setting. Okay? I think if you talk to trial lawyers, defense and plaintiffs, and say, in places where arbitration is mandated, uninsured motorist claims, UM claims, have been that way for years, what's your experience there? I think most of them would say plaintiffs get treated a little bit better in that system. They get through quicker, they get through cheaper, they get more money. So I think that would be what you'd hear. So the next question is, if that's the way it is, how come I don't want to unqualifiedly endorse it? Well, here's why. Any system can be co-opted, in my view. Any system. And guess what? I believe that the people that are going to co-opt that system the best, the quickest, are the richest, the most powerful, the best organized. And I don't represent those people. I represent your constituents, most of whom are just ordinary folks that don't know, couldn't find Juno with a map, a compass, and a guide, that don't have any money, don't have any power, and are going to get left out of that process. The ultimate leveling device, gentlemen, is the jury system. That's the bottom line. And it didn't get stuck into everybody's constitution by accident. And that's why I would be concerned about alternate dispute resolution. Because, once again, it's an infringement on that process. It's subject to being co-opted. Ordinary people are going to ultimately, could be, the losers in that situation. And that would be the reason for my concern.
But, Mike, you don't see that in the lion's share of the cases that are, say, not too seriously injured. For example, maybe, as I indicated earlier in my testimony, what about those folks who maybe are out of work for 6 months, or they're injured but they're not deformed or maimed or things, you know, things of this nature. They're incapacitated on a long-term basis. That some sort of alternative resolution in their behalf.
Or they had the option.
Or they had the option.
No, I think it'd be great.
Of going through it. For one thing, you know, as I said before, people have to realize that our whole court system is driven by the number of actions that are brought to it. And the more actions that are brought to it, of course, the more expense that we all have to pay. We in the legislature appropriate annually 30-some-odd million dollars, you know, just to maintain the court system there.
I think that would be a practical approach. And there are a lot of things. For instance, if you come to me and you're hurt and you have a, let's say, mid-level claim, and I've got to tell you that you can go to a jury trial, you can go to arbitration, I'd have to also tell you that today you'd be better served to go to arbitration. You get a quicker resolution, maybe a little cheaper. But certainly, you know, time's money, certainly faster. Probably get it heard by people that are experts in injuries. And I would encourage you to waive your constitutional rights and do that. And I think...
Well, you think it ought to be an option as opposed to in the law, huh?
I guess my own thought is you'd have a hard time making it mandatory and have it, yeah, and not have it constitutionally infirm. I mean, I haven't given that much thought, but I think you'd have a problem there. And if the legislature is going to do something here, I think it'd be wise to see if the economic incentives that are out there actually drive people to the correct decision, and I think it'd be wise to do it in a form that's going to pass constitutional muster.
Okay. Question?
Thank you very much, Michael.
I think we're just doing wonderful here. It's 2 minutes after 3, and at this stage of our agenda, we're going into the general public testimony, and going to invite Mr. Choate. You are welcome to come right up first here. Mark, welcome to the committee, and pleased to have you here to testify before us on House Bill 292. If you would, for the record, please, your name and your affiliation, sir.
Okay. My name is Mark Choate. I live in Juneau. I live next door to the governor, 230 West 8th Street. My child goes to Harborview School. My wife is a homemaker. I have an office about a block away from here. I'm a trial lawyer. I'm a member of the Alaska Academy of Trial Lawyers. I'm a member of the Association of Trial Lawyers of America. But fundamentally, I'm a Juneau resident and an Alaskan, and that's why I'm here today. I expect that the Alaska Academy and other trial lawyers have done, you know, probably a much better job than I could ever do about talking about this bill in particular. I asked Bill for the opportunity to come and talk because I see this bill, along with other tort reform measures, as being part of a consistent effort to take away from Alaskans the right to jury trial. I am in my 15th year of practice and represent individuals on a full-time basis, generally against some forms of entities, whether it's government, it's insurance companies, it's banks, it's major corporations. Probably 50% of the products liability cases we file these days are against Japanese corporations. So we and against numbers of corporations in Europe. My concern with restricting the right to trial by jury is it seems to be part of a general fear that those in power always have regarding the individual and the people on the street. Trial by jury has always been the one place where an American, no matter what their station in life, could go to have 12 of their peers talk to them, you know, and listen to their story and make a decision that's fair. And my experience has been in jury trials over the last 15 years, the juries have a level of common sense, apply a community norm to listening to these decisions, which you just can't find anywhere else. Whenever I see tort reform go on, I'm always reminded of when we were all kids in school. We used to get the little insurance packages in elementary school where a finger would be valued at a certain amount, an eye would be valued at a certain amount, you'd lose a leg for a certain amount. You used to figure out how many body parts you could lose to get a new bicycle. You'd say, you know, if I just lose, you know, three fingers and an eye, I can get that new bike. And you'd go home and tell your parents this great idea, and they'd never quite approve of it. But, you know, one of the issues is always, you know, everyone always wants to control. They want to actuarially be able to define what their levels of risk are. And juries always add that element of the human to life. You know, they listen, and they listen to real people talk about how injuries affect them. You know, they listen to and hear from their own experiences and their own common sense what's occurred when someone's injured. And it's truly, you know, the best that we are as human beings when juries listen. And if they think it's not credible, if they don't believe you, you won't prevail. If they think you ask for too much, they won't give it to you. And I've certainly had lots and lots of juries look and say, we think your client got hurt, but we think the damages requested are too high. Or we think the other side were really terrible, and we think you should get more. I mean, it's the nature of what juries do. Unfortunately, you know, for entities, whether it's professional associations or it's of professionals or it's insurance companies, they always want to quantify that and restrict it in some fashion. And my sense is that it just generally works a hardship. You know, as a practicing lawyer, I'm still trying to figure out what happened the last time you guys reformed the law in terms of tort reform. And all it's done, in my experience, has created much more litigation than ever existed before. Cases that we used to be able to settle, we can't settle now because of several liability and all the issues that were raised because of that. I mean, maybe that, you know, the result is that more lawyers stay busy, and that's good for lawyers who get paid by the hour. For people like myself who work in a contingency, it's not as good. I mean, we'd like to see expeditious and cost-effective results. It's good for our clients, and it's good for us as business people. I would ask you to look, you know, really carefully at any time you restrict people's access to a jury or restrict the juror's ability to award damages, you know, to decide liability and award damages. My experience is simply that no one holds the common sense of the community better than 12 people brought in off the street. It just is a uniform experience I've had. And you know, it drives me nuts that the various groups here have to hire lobbyists to try and affect the legislature. And I notice there's lobbyists from both sides here in the room today. And I think as a citizen of the state, I'm offended consistently by the concept that people spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on the theory that lobbyists will, in some fashion or other, influence public officials of any kind. I just think it's flat wrong. You know, I'm not a paid lobbyist. As I said, I walked up from my office, but I truly am concerned that we give juries the right to make these critical decisions. To this end, Bill, I brought one client with me who, for the public testimony portion, if it's possible, I'm going to speak. Mark Bartlett is an electrician who was working at Greens Creek, was fired when he made an overtime claim and went from earning about $80,000 a year to earning about $25,000 a year with two kids in high school. I think it was 4 years to trial. The jury of 12 of his peers found unanimously for Mark and against Greens Creek, finding that they retaliated against him. But for the jury system, but for our trust in those 12 people, Mark would never have received justice.
Four years?
Yes.
Is that concluded?
Yes, it does. Yeah.
Mark, one of the things that I was hoping you might be able to provide us is some practical insight as to how it works through your office. About how many cases approach your door and how many do you take? Are there appreciable numbers of folks with what you think might be legitimate claims but difficult to prove that fall through the cracks, do not receive adequate representation, or go to a trial by jury?
Well, first of all, the actual trial process is probably the one of the smallest elements of the whole litigation process. Very few cases go to trial. I mean, we litigate lots of cases, and still only a very small number get to trial. They get resolved along the way. In our office, we reject about 93% of the cases that come to our door. And so, and part of it is because Alaska is an expensive place. We have to be able to look at the cost benefits of the litigation, and people will have injuries, and often because the injuries are minor, we'll say we just don't think it's worthwhile to bring the case, or they'll be injured, but it's no one else's fault. And certainly, it's to my advantage to tell them it's not, you know, it's no one else's fault. I mean, all you need is to have somebody pump them up and tell them they got a great case and go out and lose, and it's not very good for you, and they don't feel very good afterwards. So there's a lot, you know, we do a tremendous amount of screening within our profession in this. Telling
what
people.
What percentage did you say that you probably don't take?
93%. We take about 7 cases out of 100 right now.
I see.
Certain cases we simply cannot afford to take because of the defenses. We see 2 or 3 cases a month where people have probably legitimate medical malpractice or medical negligence claims, but the damages are under $100,000 based upon the uniform approach by the medical profession, which is they fight every one of them. We have a very difficult time. We just can't represent those people at those levels. So we refer them north or south, but generally they don't get lawyers. And it's because the size of the claim, I can't spend $100,000 in time to recover at best $100,000 for a client. You know, I have to, in some fashion, make it pay over time. But it's one of the restrictions. Manufacturers are sort of a similar fashion. You can be injured by a bad product, but unless the injury is terrible, chances are you have a very difficult time getting a lawyer. Not because it's not a good claim, not because you haven't been damaged, but because the institutional defense is so strong that it just you can't afford to take it to trial.
Wouldn't that then, Mark, at least beg a consideration of some sort of an alternative method in order to get that person who can't attract your services to some sort of a reconciliation without, I mean, it seems to me like from what I've read and in the background, looking at some of the national and as well as some of the major writings on this subject, that an awful lot of people are just exactly in that 93% that never get represented, mm-hmm. and they're just out, you know. And yet they probably have some legitimate claim.
Well, I think that it's like anything. I mean, I'm reluctant to create a second system mm-hmm. to resolve disputes. We do more and more arbitrations and mediations, and we actually fly to Seattle from here to do them down at the jams. And with uninsured motorist policies, there's usually an arbitration provision within those policies, so you have to go to arbitration.
So you do dispute resolution right now?
You bet.
Short of going to court?
We do.
I see.
However, the difficulty is there has to, I mean, while I'm not, I don't think any system is perfect, one of the concerns you always have is, where are the cost benefits? If someone has a $10,000 claim, I don't care whether you have state workers adjusting that or mediating it or somebody else, there's going to be some difficulties economically in ever representing that person. And what I think happens here in Alaska is that for people who have you know fairly solid and larger claims, they tend to go to a certain type of practitioner. Other practitioners who probably do less personal injury work might take smaller claims. We do claims for $10,000. I mean, but generally there'll be cases where they're, you know, we have a pretty good sense that we can win them without putting a lot of time in them. But I think the system provides access. I mean, I think it's in certain areas that it doesn't. And honestly, in the medical area is a very tough one for claimants.
Questions? Committee? Joe? You have a question?
Yeah, if we could, thank you, Mr. Chairman, if we could maybe walk into the hypothetical arena for just a while.
Sure.
Now. You indicated that, and I think the speaker who spoke just prior to you indicated that, by and large, the big number of cases don't go to court.
Right.
You'll take a case and end up in some sort of a compromise.
Mm-hmm.
Is that compromise, in your opinion, because of the extended length of time that might be required to go to litigation, clear through the process, or where do you exercise the judgment with your clients to say that I could get a third of a $500,000 suit, but it's going to take me several months, or I could suggest that we settle for half of this, and I can do that in a fairly short time.
Mm-hmm.
In your opinion, do compromises come from expediency or from the fact that as a trial attorney you're trying truly to get the best for your client?
Well, I think that's a good question. I think among people who are professionals, and certainly I'm very proud of calling myself a trial lawyer. I would never look to say take the fast money because it's the quickest way to make some money. I think down in California where there are really large volumes of peoples, where you might have 3,000 or 4,000 claimants, there are mills like that. I've heard about them. I've talked to insurance adjusters down there. I know they exist. However, in Alaska, to my knowledge, I don't know any practice in the state where people have enough volume to where they can afford to settle cases cheaply or quickly just because they're processing so many cases. The nature of our small population, where we're the size, really the entire population of the state's the size of a small city down south, really prevents that from occurring. What you'll do is I think you'll see lawyers who are not as experienced in personal injury work who may resolve cases at a lower amount. And some of that is just simply level of experience. However, in Juneau, we can try a case within a year of starting it out. So we're talking generally 12 months from the moment we file suit to where we go to trial, which is not a very long time in terms of putting together your witnesses and your discovery and preparing for trial. So we found that there have been no real time restrictions in the sense of the court's calendar. I mean, the calendar's been very good for us. So generally, if we compromise cases, it's because we look at the liability issues. You know, how do they fall out? Is generally no one person's at fault in an accident. There's generally lots of different people at fault, often the plaintiff as well. And you have to consider that. You have to look at the damages, how solid they are. Some people will have a minor injury and it'll destroy their life because of who they are personality-wise or lack of other resources. Other people will get paralyzed from neck down. They'll just plug right on. You know, you just never know. And all those factors go into do we go forward with trial or not. However, you know, my experience is that generally there aren't delays within the system right now which force compromise. Down in King County, 4 or 5 years. Down in San Francisco, I try some cases in the San Francisco and Los Angeles area. We talk about 4 years sometimes. Sure, 4 years will make a big difference. But here, if we push hard, we could actually get a trial date in about 5 months. So Juneau's not bad at all. And we did, as a matter of fact, real recently against a local company where my fellow had received some food poisoning, was dying. It just destroyed his liver, and we didn't think he'd make it to the trial. So I haven't noticed those problems. And my experience in Anchorage is that with the fast track system, it's not, I mean, it comes along pretty quick. No one's had a real problem getting trial dates.
just to follow up, if I could ask you, now you said you work on a contingent basis.
Yes.
If you were involved in litigation and it appeared that it would be a good idea to try and compromise, the fact that you don't spend nearly as much time on that, do you change your percentage that you get as compensation when the trial is a short duration versus that which may take a longer time?
It depends. depending upon the case, I mean, it's one thing about being your own boss is you can pretty much set, you know, set the parameters. And at times when I know my client needs a certain amount of money, I mean, whether it's for future medicals or future care, we'll say, well, look, we'll compromise. We'll eat some of the cost in the case, or we'll reduce our fee to get you X amount if I think it's necessary to get a case settled. I mean, cost-wise for me as a businessman, it's also worthwhile to make adjustments to try to get cases settled. However, sometimes cases are resolved where you're earning more than your hourly rate. I mean, you might earn two or three times your hourly rate, and those are always the nice ones because there are cases where you earn far less than your hourly rate or actually lose money. And it depends on the year. I mean, some years, you know, my business does extraordinarily well, and we make lots of money. And, you know, last year we lost almost $100,000. This year we're making it up again. But it's the nature of the contingency fee practice is it attracts people who are willing to take more risk. And attracts people, you know, and I like to say I wear a white hat. I love what I do. I like representing people who've been hurt and trying to make a difference in their lives. So it's important to me.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mark. I think that one thing that would benefit me at any rate is I presume at any rate you've gotten a copy of the bill.
Yes.
There's a whole series of provisions in there that it's awfully difficult for those of us who are trying to establish public policy to understand many of them. And I've talked to Michael from the Trial Association, and I think I've gotten some answers from him. But would you mind maybe sometime when you have time to kind of go through them and just provide me and the committee with your personal observations on some of the proposals that we have there? You know, the committee has heard itself accused of only trying to – of abandoning the victim and only being concerned about, you know, the big industries and things of this nature there. And what I've been trying to point out here is that there's only a finite amount of money that's available out there, and cost of living is a valuable aspect, I think, in the state of Alaska as well. And I saw some of the provisions in the bill here as ones that would reduce the amount of available resources, hopefully more of them to go to legitimate victims, not necessarily dealing with, say, attorney fees or some percentage of that nature there, but the total cost of the system, whether or not the system is streamlined enough, whether or not there's areas within the system that you could streamline it more, define the cost efficiencies and the cost benefit that in turn could be made available to, say, legitimate, either end users, consumers. You know, we're talking about astronomical health care costs, things of this nature. So if you wouldn't mind sometime at your convenience, if you could just kind of go through there, and I don't need a whole lot, but just your observations on these various provisions would help me.
Okay. The one thing in that regard is, I forgot to mention earlier is, one of the things that I consistently see when we try to statutorily change the system is that we end up taking cost away from insurance companies in the sense of reducing their risk, reducing their payouts, and the public normally picks it up. When the workers' compensation system was revised, the end result was more and more workers, because they couldn't get those funds from comp, turned to state, vocational rehab, or other resources. You know, when I read this, you know, my sense again is that it's, you know, what we all buy insurance, you know, and I buy malpractice insurance just like doctors do, you know, and I pay for comp insurance and liability insurance and, you know, probably a dozen different kinds of insurance for my business just like everyone else does. That's an expense I can choose. I can say I need to be protected in these areas, I buy insurance. I don't have a particularly great deal of sympathy for the insurance carriers who are able to set their rates, and to my knowledge there's no true lack of insurance in this state for any professional, and certainly not for lawyers. And lawyers get sued much more successfully than doctors do, I'll tell you that. It's just the nature of it, because juries aren't as sympathetic to them for some reason. But my sense is that I think it's careful when you talk about where apportioning dollars, that we don't simply put more public dollars into the process. I mean, as a taxpayer, I'm obviously concerned about that. And I tend to believe the private insurance system works real well for America. I mean, it may not be perfect in all respects, but it tends to allow us, if I want my employees to have medical coverage, I can get insurance for them, you know, and we do that. And I think that's part of what we all purchase in our society. So, thank you
very much. All right, now we're going to be moving along here. I have Hillary Frazier, I think, here. And then I'm going to be moving to Anchorage. We'll be calling upon Chris Christensen. Anchorage is Christensen there, please. Anchorage, you just flew over. Well, I want to see, first of all, if you'd stand by just for a minute here, I want to see if we have, I have down on my list here, Hillary Frazier. If Hillary Frazier is in the room, and I'm looking now, and I don't see any hands, so yes, I'll take Chris Christensen, please. If they could step forward and give us their name and their affiliation, and we'd like their testimony, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, this is Chris Christensen. I'm the General Counsel to the Judicial Branch of Government. As the members of the committee know, the Supreme Court, as a general rule, does not take a position on legislation. Passage of legislation is a matter of public policy, which our Constitution leaves to the purview of the legislature. The exception to this general rule is when legislation directly affects the internal administration of the court. Most of HB 292 does not fall into this category, and the court takes no position on those sections of the bill. However, HB 292 does propose to change one important court rule, Civil Rule 82. As you know, that rule provides that the prevailing party in a civil suit is entitled to recover a portion of its attorney's fees. Section 24 of this legislation would repeal Rule 82 in tort cases. I've been instructed by the Supreme Court to state its opposition to this change. This opposition is not made lightly. This is the first time in my recollection that the court has formally opposed a change to one of its rules. I've reviewed the material submitted by Alaskans for Liability Reform. The stated justification for the repeal of Rule 82 is to, quote, reduce litigation costs and court time and streamline the civil process for expediency and fairness. The Supreme Court disagrees that this would be the result of the repeal of Rule 82. Rule 82 and its predecessors have been around in Alaska since 1884. The rule has been continuously revised over the years, and the Supreme Court completed a substantial multi-year revision just this last July. The latest revisions were intended to make the operation of the rule even more fair, and we believe that this goal was achieved. Now, what is Rule 82? In a very basic sense, Rule 82 is a rule which recognizes the reality of attorney fees. Such fees are an inherent part of any civil justice system. Rule 82 has a dual effect. In the interest of fairness, it provides partial compensation to the party who wins a lawsuit. It also streamlines the civil justice process. Let me briefly expand on this. First, in the view of the court, Rule 82 discourages unfounded lawsuits by plaintiffs. Relatively few plaintiffs are willing to press a frivolous case against the defendant if they know that the likely result is that they will end up paying $5,000 or $10,000 or $15,000 in attorney's fees to the defendant. Rule 82 weeds out many of those plaintiffs who know that their claim has no real merit or who are simply motivated by getting even, revenge. Second, Rule 82 gives the plaintiff a personal stake in a lawsuit. This personal stake would otherwise be lacking in a case where the plaintiff was represented by an attorney with a contingent fee arrangement. Now, what's the significance of giving the plaintiff a personal financial stake? Very simply, a plaintiff is a lot more likely to disclose the weak points of his case to his attorney up front than to express a realistic attitude in evaluating it. This enables the attorney to early on evaluate his client's case more fairly by shifting the emphasis away from sympathy, revenge, or so-called principle. Cases which are evaluated fairly and early by the plaintiff and his attorney are more likely to settle early. Third, Rule 82 makes it more likely that insurance companies will settle claims before the hiring of lawyers or the filing of lawsuits. If a claim is clearly valid, the company has an economic incentive not to allow the plaintiff to file a suit. Thus, Rule 82 gives insurance companies an extra incentive to evaluate claims early and fairly. Without Rule 82, a potential defendant cannot, without the risk of incurring expense to himself, sit around and simply wait to see if the plaintiff will hire an attorney and file a lawsuit, you know, just to see if the plaintiff is really serious about the matter. Fourth, Rule 82 allows plaintiffs with small cases to bring them. Understand that attorneys generally will not handle small cases on a contingent fee basis. The amount of work relative to the potential payback makes it too great a risk. Plaintiffs with small claims generally have to pay attorneys on an hourly basis, just as defendants do. The reality is that a plaintiff won't file a claim for $20,000 if he knows that he will end up giving it most of it to his lawyer. Rule 82 ensures that if the plaintiff knows the defendant will pay at least a portion of his fees. Without Rule 82, defendants would have an incentive to ignore meritorious small claims because they know that it would not be economic for the plaintiff to hire an attorney. Fourth, Rule 82 discourages marginal appeals by the losing party. Of course, the losing party in a lawsuit has to have grounds to appeal. Many times they have borderline grounds, and these grounds can be bargained against the Rule 82 fee award that the winning party got after trial. By this mechanism, the rule again prompts a realistic evaluation of the merits of the case before an appeal is filed and more court time is wasted. Finally, Mr. Chairman, in a very basic sense, Rule 82 is fair. In each lawsuit, there's a winner and a loser. One party has a claim or a defense that's valid, and the other is not. Rule 82 partially compensated for the cost of prosecuting and defending the suit. Without relating to, the winning party is solely responsible for its own attorney's fees, solely responsible for bearing the cost of a lawsuit that it never should have been involved in. The court does not believe that this is fair. Mr. Chairman, with regard to the cost of HB 292, we have circulated the latest draft among a number of court personnel in order to determine if it will have a fiscal impact on the court system. In the latest work draft, we note that certain sections will have an impact by increasing our workload, and a fiscal note will be submitted. Understand that in any civil justice system, there are costs that must be borne by the plaintiffs, costs that must be borne by the defendants, and certain costs that must be borne by the state. The thing to keep in mind is that HB 292 does not really simplify the current tort system. It merely changes it. What it does is it redistributes costs between plaintiffs and defendants. Now, whether this is appropriate is purely a matter of policy left up to the legislature. That's what you're going to decide. You should be aware, however, that some of these changes will result in the tort system being more expensive for the state to administer. And let me give you two examples. At the present time, the defendant has no right to pay a civil judgment periodically. Plaintiffs do have this right, but they rarely request it because generally they do not view it as being in their economic best interest. Now, this makes life easy for the court system because we don't need to have hearings on this issue. Section 12 and 13 of the work draft allow a defendant to make periodic payments to a successful plaintiff. The judgment must set the amount of the payments, including any increases for anticipated inflation, the interval between payments, and the number of payments. Now, setting these payments will require expert testimony from dueling economists regarding the anticipated future inflation rate, in addition to those other issues which would now be considered. The bottom line is that we will now have many hearings that we don't have at the current time. A second example, Mr. Chairman, is found in Section 14, which relates to collateral benefits. This is a very complex section which essentially provides that the amount which a defendant owes to a plaintiff will be reduced by whatever insurance benefits the plaintiff has. Now, this sounds very simple, but implementing it will require time in order to take testimony regarding all the various types of coverage which might be involved, the amount paid, determining which payments are offsetable and which are not, and so on. Again, the decision to allow or disallow collateral benefits is one public policy that's left up to you. The legislature should simply be aware that it will cost the state more to administer than the current system. Now, we have not finished calculating all the costs. I'm not certain what there are some provisions of the bill which might have the effect of reducing some court time. At this point, we suppose that the net effect of the legislation will be an increase in cost, which is why we will be attaching a positive fiscal note. Now, let me give you just one example of how this might affect it. Using the two examples that I just gave, I would say that during the course of a year in the state, we have about 100 in a tort area in Superior Court, approximately 100 cases that either result in a full-blown trial or which have extensive motion practice and end up getting dismissed or upheld on a summary judgment basis. If having to have periodic, if having to have extra hearings or extra days of trial in these 100 cases, this is 1.5 days for each case, put out up to 150 days a year, which is about 3/4 of a Superior Court judge's time over the course of the year. Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions that the members may have.
Thank you. Chris, are there any questions? We hear no questions here. Chris, do you have your testimony in writing?
I can prepare something, Mr. Chairman, and submit it if you like.
We would appreciate it. We're without a secretary, and I don't trust her voice. It would be appreciative. Thank you. If you could just send us something in writing, if you have some of your notes, even would kind of help us keep track of it here. We're trying to build a good record here. No disrespect, Royce. Thank you very much, Chris. At this time, we're going to go to the next one in Anchorage while we're up there, and I think it's Al Tamagni.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I'm two members of the House Land and Commerce Committee. It's a pleasure to appear before you today and to support many aspects of HB 292, which are intended to reduce the cost of litigation, make the largest amount of the funds to innocent victims, and to rightfully protect those in defense in a fair and just manner for all parties. Currently, as we know, the civil liability system is unbound and unfair, mostly in the instances of innocent victims and innocent defendants. We have seen on the federal level an extensive change in the discussion.
discovery rules that are going into effect in the federal level. This was put together by federal judges, law professors, who said there's problems with our system, these changes. The same thing happens in the state system. There are new proposed changes on the discovery rules. In the state of Arizona, these discovery rules have reduced the defense cost of litigation by 25% to 35%. We've encouraged and supported these elements. One of the many questions and topics that have been raised as to what have the Tort Reform Act of 1906 and the initial 1988 have done. The most important thing that's been accomplished by these acts is reflected in the report of Tort Reform Legislation, Zero Liability, by Richard Z. Eckhauser and Kip Kostuski from Harvard Kennedy School of Government and the Department of Economics at Duke University, in which they state, like any other factor in production, should have a ready supply zone that price reflects its long-term time cost. The Liability Act, by taking this from their information in the report, the Liability Reform Act of the mid-1980s would more than constrain the filing cost of insurance. We stabilize the insurance market and thereby foster the sound function of the economy, while at the same time saving American consumers approximately $2.5 billion in future premium increases. Alaska is one of those states that were contained within that study. They also find that in regards to the state of Alaska, particularly in the areas of the modified joint and federal liability, that affects approximately 53% to 55% of the premium dollars, affect that percentage of the dollars. The limits on liability, which affect approximately 11% to 14% of the premium, limits on economic damages, which affect approximately 12% to 14% of the premium dollars, and structured period payments, which affect approximately 10% to 12% of the premium dollars. We think, Mr. Chairman, that these are positive accomplishments and need some small refinement, and we need to further efficientize the operation of risk assistance. So the large part of the work goes to the victim in a prompt, fair, and factual manner, the least amount of cost to the consumers providing these services. We feel that our substantial wrongs being committed in the civil justice and the criminal statute should go after the bodies to reflect the criminal prosecution where the actual criminals are punished for the crimes they personally commit, and the cops are not made the victims of the system. I would simply like to highlight a couple of the issues on damages resulting from the commission of a crime, which the trial lawyers apparently support the position that the criminal should be rewarded and the cop should be punished. We feel like this is a total injustice, not supported by 75% of Alaskans, and should be supported as proposed. We find that the process of the proposal of the trial lawyers and current payments is far, far best and to render one to think and question the credibility of this plot. Read my data, Mr. Chairman, I practice in the area of current payments for 12 years. So therefore, I consider an expert in that field. With this type of legal representation, the winner of our civil justice system is in the state of disarray, which is apparently in review of restructuring trade on a state basis. We find that parent things are a very useful mechanism. They provide long-term, tax-free income to people who are injured. We find that when they are presented with optional choices of settlement and are properly informed of their consequences, are readily acceptable to the abuse. We find with the assignment of treasury certificates, guarantees, and guarantors of other life insurance companies that the market is substantially far safer than bringing money into the certificates pot of the local bank. Many of them who have gone broke in the last 8 to 10 years. We find there are substantial guarantees from the Alaska Health and Disability Guarantee Association in Alaska and in other states. The IRS agrees. Congress agreed that these are beneficial safeguards to our society as a whole under Section 104A2 of the IRS Code. We find that plaintiff attorneys in most cases, and I have to say this, I don't like it, but I have to, do not personally like structured settlements, as it requires a little additional work on their part and also requires them to perform and give their client informed consent. We see this as one of the major problems in the profession today. Victims are not given offers of judgment that reflect current payments. They are not given informed consent. They are not properly disclosed. they are not properly presented. We feel like this is an aspect that has been abused in practice by many of the trial lawyers, and not all of them. There are many trial lawyers out there who support this practice and concept. We feel to restrict the hands of the jury is improper and does not prevent the interest of society as a whole, that our jury should be able to make these decisions. And the award period paid. In fact, it was the jury that first came out with the concept in 1972. We feel the offer of judgment interest rate of 3% above the federal discount rate is efficient. Efficient in two ways: to adequately and fairly compensate the victim on a floating basis, or to find that it would have passed and advanced at the time it would have received the money. As far as that went from here, our certificate of deposit today, considering certificates of deposit by taxes. It is probably more important to note that our position that neither the defense nor the plaintiff should dictate the schedule of the trial and the progress of the case. It is the responsibility of the third branch of government, i.e. the court system, to better represent the public, that when a case is filed, it is their responsibility and solely the responsibility to see that that case is immediately processed through the system in a fair, efficient, and effective manner. We, for years, Mr. Chairman, have complained to the Supreme Court about this practice. They have made some modifications. They have responded to the general public. They still have a long way to go, but they're making progress. As you know, we, the general public, have virtually no input on a majority of cases into either the Alaska Judicial Council, the Alaska Bar Association, or the Judicial Conduct Commission. All three of those committees are represented by a majority of lawyers. Therefore, the public has virtually no input into those institutions which establish the rules of the court, establish recommendations. They are not required to hold public hearings on any of their rules or any of their change in the bylaws, as i.e. the Alaska Judicial Commission most recently had an amendment to their bylaws with no public hearing. We find this is an area that needs to be improved. We need to be concerned about the collateral source and the purpose of the collateral source so that jurors, our peers, our friends, can offset any awards that fees have already been paid in regards to the settlement. Now, you know what the big problem is why the trial lawyers don't like the collateral offset before the judgment is rendered? Because the jury can say, well, this case is worth probably $1 million. They've already received $300,000, so we're going to make the award at $700,000. You know what the problem is? Because the attorney doesn't get his 50% commission at that point on the $300,000. That's the problem. That's why I think this is a good bill, and many fellow Alaskans think it's a good bill. It's fair, juries are smart, it's our system, give them that right to decide. The bill virtually affects every Alaskan, whether they buy homeowners insurance policies, automobile insurance policies, or they buy some property and casualty liability insurance. I would disagree to a regard on the Supreme Court's Rule 82 position. The Alaska Supreme Court, we have pressured them for years to change Rule 82 to be more fair and balanced. Currently, Rule 82 is a privilege granted to people by the court. Our proposal to the Supreme Court was that persons should be compensated 100% for their attorney fees, and it should be a right, not a privilege, and should be paid above the judgment amounts. This would virtually, Mr. Chairman, save consumers approximately 15% on judgments. The Supreme Court, nor do have the Bar Association, prohibited Rule 82 awards from becoming a part of the recovery, i.e., if there is a Rule 82 award, many attorneys consider that to be part of the judgment, and they take 40 to 50% of that. We think that Rule 82 should be exempt from any contingency fee recovery. That's going to be in effect. It should be paid directly to the plaintiff and not subject to any additional charges. We feel the same, Mr. Chairman, by prejudgment interest, that all of that interest should go directly to the victim. None of that should go to the attorney, but that is a right that you should have by law. I wish to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your considerations and allowing us to present these arguments. I hope and promptly move the bill out of committee for the benefit of all working Alaskans and their families. On behalf of the answer, any questions you may have.
Thank you, Al. We would appreciate also if you have your testimony in writing, if you would mail it to my office, and I'll see that the balance of the committee members receive a copy of it. It's really difficult to follow a lot of these technical aspects, and it would help us to have that in writing so we can analyze it in more depth. Will you be able to provide your testimony in writing, Al? Do you have that in writing? If you just send me one copy, Al, you can fax it down, and then we'll make copies and see that the committee members get it. And we appreciate your testimony today, and if we have any further questions, we know who to direct them to. Thank you. Next, I'd like to go to Harlan Knutson here in Juneau. Welcome, Harlan. If you would give us your name and rank and serial number.
Thank you. Please. Mr. Chairman, I'm Harlan Knudson. That's K-N-U-D-S-O-N. I'm the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Alaska State Hospital and Nursing Home Association. I'm here today to do a couple of things. Number one, to give you a little bit of background about the association. We are a 40-member organization representing hospitals and nursing homes across the state. I'm speaking today on those 26 members who are community hospitals and nursing homes, very much in support of Senate Bill 292. And what I want to do is comment and give you a brief overview of some of the facts that I think this committee needs to look at. And I think one of our folks who testified earlier today talked about the importance of facts. One of the first facts that I want to present to the committee is that the President of the United States, in his call for health reform, has listed tort reform and the need for tort reform, and part of his legislation is an important part of health reform, that we can't control health care costs if we don't address the liability issue. I want to share with you a report from the United States Justice Department, where a very learned body of lawyers looked at our tort system and said it's a problem and have laid out solutions to this problem, some of those solutions contained in House Bill 292. I want to share with you a memo I got today from the Anchorage Chamber of Commerce. Hope I can find it. If I can, I'll get it to you. But it laid out the issues of importance to the business community in Anchorage, Alaska, and the spending of government, the cost of health care, and tort reform were the top three issues. Now, one of the things that's very difficult about this issue is that I have such a great respect for our legal system. And as Representative Porter likened earlier, you know, our distinguished friends, our neighbors, our colleagues from the Bar Association, the Trial Bar, are truly that. They're our neighbors and our friends. And if healthcare has any glaring failure in the discussion of the need for liability reform, it has been our inability to convince our friends and our neighbors and those distinguished men and ladies and gentlemen of the bar that liability, the question of tort reform, is a major issue. Now, one of the reasons that we're supporting House Bill 292, because it's the only solution on the table. It's address House Bill 292 or do nothing. And I would challenge my friends from the bar, as much as we respect the importance of trial by jury, how about the importance of access to health care in rural Alaska? How about that young mother-to-be in rural Alaska who has a family doctor, but that doctor doesn't take obstetrics. And the reason he doesn't take obstetrics is the cost of that insurance. Now, when we address the issue of the cost of liability, let's go back and give this legislature some credit. In the late 1970s, you created MICA. And even though MICA is no longer with us today, it was the vehicle that made insurance available. In 1986, you addressed the issue of liability. The results of that is you've got a healthy, competitive liability insurance market in Alaska. You can go out and buy liability insurance. That is not the question. That's not the issue we're trying to solve. In 1988, You took the issue of joint and several liability, and it was put on the ballot. I would challenge this committee to go over to the Division of Risk Management, the Department of Administration, and ask them, what impact did the passage of Proposition 2 in 1988 have on the availability of reinsurance for states like the state of Alaska that self-insure? I think you're going to find that the London market changed dramatically when this state took action in that area. I think that's an instance we continually hear prove to us that liability reform is going to have an impact. Well, I think we can do that. I think there's some very easily measures. We're not going to address the cost of the liability insurance itself. You know, that's out there, and that will fluctuate with the market. But let's talk about the cost of liability to the healthcare system. You know, this is the guts. Let's take, and let me come back with some hard facts on the anatomy of a lawsuit and what it costs the defense of a hospital, what it costs in time and energy and in all of that in this kind of a system. I think that if our friends from the trial bar are concerned with this, they have not laid, at least in my 5 years in the state of Alaska, they have not laid any solution to this problem on the table. They have not even admitted that it is a problem. Now, I greatly appreciate their candor, because this is the third or fourth time that you've heard gentlemen from the bar say, oh, by the way, if it's a small accident, we can't help you. Particularly if the person doesn't have any insurance, you have no recourse in this state. If you have a medical injury from an uninsured family doc in the rural area who probably isn't making very much money, the chances are nobody's going to sue him because they can't afford to. That's not fair either. You know, we talk about fairness and the rights of the patient. I want to close on one other issue, because we've heard eloquently from some individuals about rights. The right to sue at any time. I'm 45 or 50 years old, and I decide that I've had a problem with my mother or father, I have a right to sue them. I have a right to sue my pediatrician. You know, be he dead and gone, I can still sue the estate. One of the things that we have not heard from anybody that testified here today is about responsibility. One of the big drivers of healthcare costs today is the unhealthy mother-to-be. That mother's right to smoke, that mother's right to drink, that mother's right to drive dangerously, that mother's right to smoke crack. We've got a hospital in New York has 70 crack babies in one ward and growing. How about some responsibilities from the citizen? Don't they have any? You know, I think it's a two-edged sword when we look at that. I think you're going to find the healthcare community will accept its responsibilities. I think it's a tough issue. I wish we could encourage our friends from the bar to come forward and put some solutions. If 292 isn't a solution, then give us a solution that provides reasonable availability and reasonable cost insurance to the providers in this state. Give us some solutions that take some of that cost away from litigation. And part of that cost is time. You know, I think we've got some studies, and we'll look for some facts, how long it takes by the time you're sued and by the time you finally get that monkey off your back 5, 6, 7 years later. So maybe there's some solutions out there. It's not too late. But I heartily congratulate this committee for sitting here all day listening to Stormy. I don't envy you the task we got. We will do our best to give you the facts. We will do our best to talk to our friends from the bar to try and come up with some solutions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Harlan. I appreciate your very direct information here. Are there any questions from the committee? I think we're being worn out here, so the later you come in, probably the better off you are. Thank you very much, Harlan. Now I'm going to go back to Anchorage, because I don't want to keep our friends up there hanging on the line here, but I have Steve Schroeder.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Steve Schroeder.
Schroeder.
I'm a civil engineer in private practice here in Anchorage, and I wish to testify in support of House Bill 292. I'm a 35-year resident of Anchorage. I've been up there since I was a kid. I've worked continuously in Anchorage as a civil engineer for the past 20 years, 13 of those years in my own practice. The design community supports House Bill 292.
and the statute of limitation of the statute of repose in particular. The Design Committee is currently working on its own statute of repose and has been for a number of years. Most felons currently enjoy a statute of repose of less than 10 years. Only murderers and the like enjoy the same statute of repose that we do. We don't believe this is right. Actually, I don't appreciate being held in the same status with mere common felons. While the Design Community is pursuing statute of repose in a separate bill, we support this bill and the statute of limitations in it. Mr. Chairman, I have difficulty remembering what I had for breakfast on any given day, including today. Trying to remember what or why actions were taken 5, 8, 10 or more years ago in response to a claim from a claimant is at best difficult. Trying to contact other individuals who were involved or who participated is equally difficult. I don't think most of us are in the same class as manufacturers of automobiles designed to burn their passengers or airplanes or airliners. Small businesses in Alaska are finding it very difficult to bear the cost, the expense cost of these old planes. I submit that small businesses and individuals in Alaska are the parties most adversely impacted by the current lack of statute of repose. I believe the insurance industry responds to market conditions and environment. I do not believe premiums are going to come down next year if House Bill 292 were to pass the 1st of January. I believe the rates are going to be reduced over time as costs are reduced. These costs include defense costs. I think the marketplace and the market competition will see if this happens. The Design Community urges you to move House Bill 292 out of committee, and we urge your support for it. We'd be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you very much, Al. Are there any questions of the committee for Mr. Magny? No. All right. Thank you very much. I have one more that has indicated they wanted to testify, and it's Tom Finley. Is Tom still here?
Thank you, Mr. Hudson, and thank you, committee, for allowing me the opportunity to testify. I've lived in Juneau since 1976. I've been practicing law in Juneau since 1976. And I do both plaintiff's cases and defense cases, probably a little more plaintiff's work than defense work. And in my experience in Juneau and in talking with the people in Juneau, Representative Hudson, I'm not sure what you've been told, but I don't hear any complaints about the way the jury system has worked here. Many people evidently are complaining about problems in Anchorage, but there aren't very many complaints in Southeast because the juries here, so far as I can remember in 15 years, have not been unfair, or there is no perception in Juneau that the jury system has resulted in verdicts that are completely unreasonable or that aren't based in fact. So it leads me to the question of exactly what is being fixed, and throughout this afternoon, What we hear frequently is, I know this isn't going to save money. I know this isn't going to result in lower insurance costs. And I believe that. As a matter of fact, for a while I was working with the insurance industry on matters in the legislation in the early 80s. And the insurance industry, I think, would admit, especially State Farm, Allstate, Nationwide, and all of the automobile insurance companies, would admit that their rates aren't going to be set by 500,000 people in this state. They're going to be set by 5 million people in Los Angeles, the secondary market. So our rates are not going to come down if this bill is passed. I'm pretty confident from hearing everyone testify that that's the case. Perhaps, though, access to the system, or as you pointed out, Mr. Hudson, the ability to get people into the system is what this committee should try to do as a policy. And to that end, the idea of having an optional alternate dispute resolution procedure or arbitration panel is a good idea. Those who have cases that you can't afford, because to hire a doctor as an expert witness will cost from $200 to $400 to even $600 per hour. And these kind of cases, tort cases, are frequently driven by experts, all of whom are very expensive. And although those people may still testify in an arbitration case, it may be that an alternate system could be worked out. But I think before this committee wades into a policy consideration that $500,000 is enough or $10,000 is enough, or we need to make radical changes in this system, you need to take a step back and see really what, if anything, is broken. Having been on both sides and having negotiated settlements both for plaintiffs and defendants, I don't have the perception that evidently others do, that there is a fundamental flaw in the jury system. Everyone has a perception that their insurance bill is too high, but I'm not sure that anyone has gone through this bill and figured out just exactly how much money you can go back and tell your constituents you have saved for them. I'm afraid the answer will be that you haven't saved much of anything. There is one area, though, that I think could use reform, and that is, I believe the last time the legislature tinkered with the tort system, there was an attempt to create dram shop liability protections. I don't know if Mr. Choate's still here. I don't think he is, but it's kind of ironic. I have a case against Mark right now, although usually we're working together on cases. But the Dram Shop Act, I think, does need work. Right now, somebody can go out with a friend and get drunk, way too drunk to be in and around a vehicle, ride as a passenger with another person, get in an automobile wreck, and sue the person who served him alcohol. If the committee is looking at tort reform as what kind of a policy do we want to have in Alaska, this presents kind of an interesting situation, because surely this committee would not want to deprive the breadwinner of a family who is splattered by a drunk from whatever a jury would decide is a fair recovery. You can imagine all kinds of situations where that person should not be subject to any kind of economic limit. And yet everyone's saying, if there's ever anybody totally innocent, it's the person who is driving to and from wherever, totally sober, and have a drunk plow into them. But the system still allows the person who is getting drunk along with the driver to recover, and it may even allow the driver to recover against the liquor provider. That seems to me, as a policy, something that this legislature might say, we got to fix that. And that certainly would be tort reform, but it wouldn't just be capping the victims with, this is all you get, even if you deserve more. If the jury wants to award more, sorry, you don't get it. But it would make a policy statement that that we're not going to be paying verdicts to people, we're not going to pay a penny to people who get themselves drunk. In the criminal system, of course, we don't use getting yourself drunk as an excuse. And the Supreme Court and you people have all unanimously agreed that as a policy, you're not going to allow that. So maybe there is tort reform needed. I'm sure there is, but maybe it isn't the broad sweeping wade in that you're not sure is going to save a lot of money, which may be the driving force behind this. Thank you.
Thank you, Thomas. I'd be interested in maybe following up on your last comments there a little bit further. Not today, but sure. Another time, and I'll perhaps give you a call, and you can educate me a little bit further, and perhaps I can share that information with my colleagues here.
Be happy to.
Appreciate your constructive input, and any questions of the committee here?
No, I just add that's interesting, too, and there's room in here for more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else in the audience or here today that wish to testify that has not signed up? Anyone in Anchorage that has not indicated they want to testify, that's there, wish to testify?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, we have Henry Springer here.
Henry Heinrich Springer, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. I'm here to testify on House Bill 292. My name is Henry Springer. I represent the Associated General Contractors, which whose membership is consists of people in the construction industry in Alaska. Our membership is in support of House Bill 292, especially the provisions that address the question of liability and the statute of repose. Construction projects, as you all know, are a very complex thing. Unlike manufactured products with certain warranties, they involve consultants, designers, engineers, private subcontractors, suppliers, and a whole array of other peripheral people. And we just hear from the engineers, who, of course, are very involved in any type of construction project. And last but not least, the owners of the projects are, of course, involved in an Alaska to a very high degree, that is the government, interstate, federal, local. The critical point in any project from a technical, legal, contractual point is the acceptance of the product, and that is usually indicated when the final payment is made, and at that time all the bonding and insurance requirements cease. What is going to be charged then later on is our occurrences prior to that point, and that is where I think there's a real dilemma, because in all complex type of facilities, maintenance, both preventive and ongoing maintenance are a very integral part of a project, and there is absolutely no documentation or anything that would shed any light on what influence lack or wrong maintenance had. So in the case of failure of something, we have a situation where it is nearly impossible through any logical process to determine who is at fault. But the way the legal system works, contractors are being perceived as being the deep pocket guys, and they usually get stuck. That is, needless to say, that is grossly unfair, especially under the present system where, like engineers, there is no statute that a time-related element determines liability. It's an ongoing thing. We only have legal requirements from taxation purposes and other regulations to keep records for 6 and in some cases 7 years. For whatever reason, you expect contractors to, in order to safeguard their exposure to keep records into eternity. The other thing, because of the complexity, it's usually impossible to determine what exactly was the cause. On top of it, the very important people that usually are involved in a project, the foreman, superintendent, and people that have managerial oversight, they are, because of the nature of the work and the nature of the workforce, they are highly mobile, and in the rarest of cases, are they around more than a few years. And last but not least, a lot of the smaller contractors are not corporations. They are privately owned or joint ownership owned businesses. And those people go into retirement, and they have forever a cloak of personal liability hanging over their head. I don't think it takes a PhD to figure out that that is comparison with other professional industries and businesses. The construction industry is singled out together with engineers very unfairly, and for that reason, we wholeheartedly support this House bill, and especially the provisions contained in the section 09.10.052, which is basically the 6-year liability. I think it's a step in the right direction. I think 6 years is a fair period of time.
Thank you, Henry. Any questions of the committee? All right. With that, are there anybody on the net? I'm not even sure who all is still here that would like to testify. We have a few more minutes here. Going once. All right. Then that will conclude this hearing. It is now. Excuse me. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Porter. You wish to.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before you bang the gavel down, if I might, I'd like to make one comment and then read something out of the paper, or paraphrase it at least. Rather than discuss differences of perception with various witnesses, I would like to just comment that I do take exception to several times people testifying that we have not received testimony that this bill would reduce costs. I think we very positively have, and I'll let the record speak for itself from John George and Dave Walsh. But secondly, I guess I just can't miss the opportunity and the timing of this that in today's paper in the Anchorage Daily News was, I think, an example. And I'll, as a side, say I will take note that everyone who said you should not pass law based on anecdotes quickly gave one. So in response to those, I'll give one myself. One of the concerns in relating to the health care costs is pharmaceuticals, and the president has indicated that tort reform might bring some of those costs down. Maybe here's one of the reasons. SmithKline, for a period of 5 years, produced a dental plate adhesive that they discovered had trace amounts of benzene. Because of that, they elected to take it off the market. A very resourceful man who had used this product discovered this and got another resourceful attorney to sue class action to right this terrible wrong. Albeit no claim of any damage, the man didn't have cancer. But they sued, and rather than further risk their reputation, it was settled. The man who sued got $25,000 for his resourcefulness. The 650 people who, as a result of the settlement, put in claims that they had used this product got $7 apiece. Those who said that they had used this product at least once got a book of coupons for discounts. And the attorneys, the expenses and legal fees that they got were $954,934.57. That's what's broke.
Thank Joe, you. Did you wish to finalize?
All right. It is now almost 4:20, and this committee is adjourned until the session.
What a coup de grace.